It was a warm January afternoon in 2017 when the lifeless body of celebrity hairstylist Fabio Cementilli was discovered, stabbed poolside, alone in the lush backyard of his Woodland Hills estate. His wife, Monica, arrived, terrified and grieving, but soon investigators would uncover text messages, camera streams, and a tangled affair that suggested nothing about this scene was as it seemed. Amid the opulence, a Porsche in the driveway, designer labels, the promise of a $1.6 million life insurance payout. Lurking beneath was betrayal, secret lovers, and a plan that defied imagination. As the evidence mounts, Monica's seemingly perfect life begins to unravel. Was she a grieving widow or the mastermind behind the murder? Now, after years of legal wrangling and waiting, a jury prepares to decide whether lust and greed were enough to turn love into a deadly conspiracy. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favourite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Blood in the Water. The sun was still hanging low over Woodland Hills, casting golden streaks across the terracotta rooftops and backyard pools that shimmered like mirrors. In the exclusive neighbourhood just north of Los Angeles, silence usually reigned in the late afternoon. Children were at after-school activities, their parents winding down from long work days. But on January 23rd, 2017, something far darker broke that routine inside the elegant Spanish-style villa of the Cementilli family. The air was unnaturally still. The backyard, framed by manicured hedges and Roman-style columns, felt like a private resort, a place built for comfort and prestige. The only sounds were the gentle splash of pool water and the occasional rustle of dry California leaves. Fabio Cementilli was sprawled near the poolside steps, his torso slumped forward, his body twisted unnaturally. Blood had soaked into the brick patio, trailing toward the shallow water. His phone lay a few feet from his outstretched hand. Its screen cracked but still lit up. A silver Rolex clung to his wrist, untouched. His designer glasses had been knocked to the side, one lens shattered. He had been stabbed multiple times, ferociously, brutally, and left to die alone under the sun. The man was well known in his world. A global hair industry icon, Fabio had risen from humble beginnings in Toronto to become an influential executive with one of the most prestigious beauty brands in the world. To colleagues, he was passionate and relentlessly optimistic. To his family, he was a devoted husband and father. But to whoever had done this, he was a target, a disposable piece in a plan that had been months in the making. Earlier that day, Monica Cementilli, Fabio's wife of over 20 years, had left the house around 3:20 p.m. Her movements were deliberate. She said she was running errands and planned to meet their daughter later. Before she left, she'd locked the front door, glanced once at her phone, and walked out without a word. She wouldn't return home for several hours. But the questions around what she knew, when she knew it, and what she planned were about to erupt into a storm. At approximately 4:10 p.m., Isabella, the couple's teenage daughter, arrived home. The gate clicked shut behind her as she entered the side yard. At first, she didn't notice anything unusual until she rounded the corner and saw the red pool of blood and her father's motionless body. She screamed. The 911 call was frantic. The operator struggled to extract words through sobs. "My dad, he's not moving. There's blood. Please, please come quickly." Emergency units responded within minutes. Paramedics rushed to assess Fabio, but it was too late. The stab wounds, deep and clustered, had punctured vital organs. He had bled out too quickly for help to arrive in time. LAPD officers quickly secured the scene, stretching crime tape around the perimeter. The family was ushered into the house. Monica returned home as chaos unfolded. She wept uncontrollably, clutching her daughters. To the outside world, she looked like a woman gutted by tragedy, a wife robbed of her partner. Neighbours approached to offer condolences, reporters began circling, and Monica collapsed into the arms of a family friend, sobbing, "Why would anyone do this to him? He never hurt anybody." But detectives on the scene were already uneasy. Something didn't add up. Burglary was floated as a possible motive. The house had signs of disturbance, and Fabio's black Porsche was missing from the garage. It was recovered a few miles away, abandoned near a strip mall, but nothing of significant value was taken from the home. The electronics remained. Jewellery was untouched. Fabio's wallet was still in his pocket. This wasn't a robbery gone wrong. It was an execution. Clean, fast, and filled with rage. As investigators canvassed the neighbourhood for witnesses and security footage, they discovered a peculiar detail. Just before the estimated time of death, two individuals were seen jogging in the direction of the Cementilli home. Both wore hooded sweatshirts. They kept their heads down. One had a noticeable limp. The footage wasn't clear enough for identification, but detectives flagged it. The time window matched perfectly. Inside the Cementilli home, police began combing through digital records. They retrieved Fabio's laptop, iPads, and Monica's home computer. They asked for access to phone records. Monica agreed, but her demeanour shifted. She was quieter now, less overwhelmed, more calculated in her speech. "Fabio worked so hard," she told detectives. "He loved his daughters. He didn't deserve this." The lead investigator nodded. "He was a good man." She nodded. "The best. I still don't understand why someone would do this." But that wasn't true, because by the next morning, detectives would begin to uncover a narrative far more twisted than a home invasion. A story about secrets, affairs, and a motive that could only be born from desire and greed. Days later, the first cracks appear. Detectives pulled phone logs from Monica's cell provider. What they found stunned them. On the day of the murder, Monica exchanged over 90 text messages with one man, and the day before, 180. The texts were constant, intimate, and encrypted. That man was Robert Baker, a racquetball coach she had known for years, who had once trained her husband, then her daughter, and then, slowly, became something else. He was older than Monica by nearly a decade, tall, broad-shouldered, and confident. He had a checkered past, a former adult film performer and a registered sex offender. He lived a relatively quiet life in Reseda, renting a small, cluttered apartment and working sporadically as a personal trainer. Monica had met him at a racquetball club. What began as flirtation turned quickly into a full-blown affair. Friends would later say Monica changed. She became distant, edgy, more concerned with appearances than connection. At home, she and Fabio had grown apart. She told close friends he was too distracted by work, always travelling, but she never told them she was in love with someone else. In the months leading up to the murder, Monica and Baker messaged constantly. Investigators discovered that Baker had visited her home when Fabio was away. They shared fantasies about a new life together. One message chilled detectives to the core. "He's in the way. Always has been. Maybe soon we can finally have what we deserve." For detectives, this was no longer a murder case. It was a conspiracy. The turning point. Within 2 weeks, DNA results came back from the crime scene. Underneath Fabio's fingernails, they found genetic material, male, not a family member. A match was made. It belonged to Robert Baker. This was no coincidence. Baker was called in for questioning, but denied everything. He said he hadn't seen Monica in weeks. He claimed he was home the day of the murder, watching television alone. But his phone told a different story. Location data placed him in Woodland Hills that afternoon, just a few blocks from the Cementilli residence. A warrant was issued to search Baker's home. Inside, detectives found a duffel bag with latex gloves, a change of clothes, and a kitchen knife wrapped in a towel. There was blood on the handle. Preliminary testing suggested it matched Fabio's DNA. Baker was arrested on suspicion of murder, but the deeper revelation came when detectives traced his calls. Not only had Monica been in contact with him every day for months, but she had been watching the house's security system remotely from her phone at the exact time her husband was being killed. That was the final straw. 3 months later, Monica Cementilli was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. The arrest shocked their community. Some refused to believe it. Others whispered, "I knew something was off." Monica maintained her innocence. She said she had nothing to do with the killing, that Robert had acted alone. But the evidence was overwhelming. The woman who had once cried in front of TV cameras, who had stood in front of Fabio's casket at his funeral and wept beside her daughters, was now behind bars, awaiting trial. And this was only the beginning. Chapter 2. The Public Face and the Private Marriage. From the outside, Fabio and Monica Cementilli looked like the very embodiment of success. Fabio was a star in the beauty world. As vice president of education for a global cosmetics company, he traveled the world, hosting industry events, coaching stylists, and judging elite hair competitions. With a warm smile and an infectiously positive energy, Fabio became a mentor to thousands of young professionals. He wasn't just a businessman, he was an icon. At home, he was known as a loving husband, a dedicated father, and a man of discipline. Colleagues often said he worked hard, but family always came first. He loved to cook, especially Italian dishes passed down from his mother. He had a booming laugh and a habit of giving bear hugs that lasted a beat too long. His two daughters, Isabella and Jessica, were the light of his life. But inside the Cementilli home, behind the luxury and Instagram-perfect smiles, a quiet divide had been forming. Monica Cementilli was a striking woman, blonde, polished, fiercely protective of her privacy. Friends described her as reserved, elegant, and always well put together. She wasn't in the public eye the way her husband was, but she was known in beauty circles as Fabio's partner and confidant. To many, she seemed content supporting his career from behind the scenes. Still, those who knew the couple well began to notice shifts in Monica over the years. She grew quieter, more guarded. Some said she seemed distant at social events, glued to her phone. Others recalled that she sometimes spoke of stress, about Fabio's demanding travel schedule, or the pressures of managing the household largely on her own. Yet nothing hinted at what was to come. A portrait of Monica. Monica was born and raised in Canada. Like Fabio, the two had met in the early 1990s, bonding over their shared Italian roots and drive to build a life of meaning. They married young, and their lives quickly became intertwined with Fabio's rising career. He was charismatic, spontaneous, and always dreaming big. Monica was grounded, pragmatic, and detail-oriented. At first, they were a perfect match. Together, they raised three children, Fabio's son from a previous relationship, Luigi, and their two daughters. The family eventually relocated to Los Angeles, drawn by career opportunities and a more glamorous lifestyle. But Monica was not content simply to be a trophy wife. Behind the scenes, she managed much of the household's logistics, real estate decisions, taxes, college planning, and, notably, the family's insurance policies. She kept meticulous records and was always in control, particularly when it came to finances. One such policy was Fabio's life insurance, a $1.6 million plan that listed Monica as the sole beneficiary. To the outside world, this made sense. They were married, successful, and building a legacy together. But what few knew was that Monica had grown resentful. She confided in friends, selectively and carefully. Fabio, she claimed, was inattentive. He travelled too often. He dismissed her concerns. She hinted at loneliness and suggested he was more in love with his job than with her. Some friends brushed it off as the usual stress of a long-term marriage, but others saw something darker. A woman simmering with frustration, slowly drifting away from the life she once fought to build. The life they built. The Cementilli estate was sprawling. Tucked away in an upscale enclave of woodland hills, it featured tall hedges, arched windows, imported marble floors, and an outdoor space worthy of a magazine cover. The couple owned multiple vehicles, including Fabio's signature black Porsche, a symbol of his hard-earned success. Inside, the house was a portrait of domestic luxury. Photographs of the family lined the walls. Vacations in Rome, birthdays, anniversaries, and holiday dinners. But to investigators who would later walk through those same rooms, the decor felt sterile. Perfectly curated, but emotionally cold. There were no sticky notes on the fridge, no school calendars, no mess. As detectives began to examine the home following Fabio's murder, they searched for signs of forced entry, any evidence that might support the theory of a home invasion. But the doors were locked. There were no broken windows. The home's state-of-the-art security system had been disabled intentionally. Monica, they noted, had full access to those controls from her phone. She could watch live security footage from anywhere, and on the afternoon of the murder, she had opened the app at least three times. The emergence of Robert Baker. While investigators dug into Monica's life, another name kept resurfacing: Robert Baker. Robert was well known at the local racquetball club. He was a fixture in the athletic community, confident, charming, and intensely private. Years earlier, he had met Monica when she joined the gym looking for a new trainer. At first, their relationship seemed professional, but within months, it had become something else. Friends of Monica's later testified that she often mentioned a friend she saw during the week. She described him as supportive and understanding. She never used his name. When Fabio was away, often on international trips, Monica and Robert would spend time together. They kept their interactions discreet. No public dates, no photos. Their communications were carefully encrypted. When text records were retrieved, detectives found hundreds of messages exchanged over just a few days. Their conversations weren't just romantic, they were strategic. Monica shared frustrations, Robert shared fantasies, and in some messages, the two discussed life after. After what? That question became central to the case. One message from Robert read, "He's the last thing standing between us and real freedom." And Monica responded, "I know. I'm ready." Fabio's blind spot. Throughout this growing web of lies, Fabio appeared oblivious. He spoke often about the love he had for Monica. In work meetings and public appearances, he referenced her as my rock and my greatest blessing. Friends said he was generous to a fault, often giving Monica expensive gifts, booking luxury vacations, and even turning down overseas promotions to be closer to home. To those who knew him best, Fabio's greatest weakness was his trust. He believed in his family, he believed in second chances, and despite the growing emotional distance between him and Monica, he continued to plan for their future. In fact, just weeks before his death, Fabio had spoken to a colleague about retiring early and launching a charity to support underprivileged hairstylists. He wanted to leave behind more than wealth. He wanted to leave a legacy. He never imagined the threat would come from within his own home. The psychology of control. As investigators began to understand Monica's personality more deeply, a troubling pattern emerged. She had spent years in control of her household. She managed every financial decision, knew the password to every device, and often mediated between Fabio and the children when tensions arose. To some, this was simply how Monica coped, with structure, with discipline, with plans. But to the detectives now poring over months of text messages and interviews, a different picture appeared. Monica was a planner, a manipulator, and someone capable of orchestrating violence without ever lifting a finger. She didn't need to commit the act herself. All she needed was someone who loved her enough, or was desperate enough, to do it for her. Enter Robert Baker, a plan in motion. By the fall of 2016, Monica and Robert's communications had shifted in tone. They weren't just lovers anymore. They were co-conspirators. They discussed routes, timing, and how to avoid detection. Robert spoke of enlisting help from someone who owed him a favour, a man later identified as Christopher Austin. Austin, a former Marine with a troubled past, had a reputation for doing favours in exchange for cash. He had served time for assault and had a history of drug abuse. Robert offered him money. Monica provided details. On the day of the murder, it's believed the two men entered the backyard through a side gate. They wore hooded sweatshirts and gloves. They waited until Monica had left the house. They attacked Fabio as he sat poolside. He fought back, brutally, but was outnumbered. He was stabbed 7 times. The house was staged to appear ransacked. The DVR containing security footage was stolen and later destroyed. But it wasn't enough, because Monica, in her own obsession with control, had overlooked one simple truth. Digital trails are permanent. And the deeper the LAPD dug, the more breadcrumbs they found. The mask falls. By spring of 2017, the theory of a random burglary had collapsed entirely. Robert was arrested in June, charged with murder. Christopher Austin was arrested shortly after and eventually agreed to testify in exchange for a reduced sentence. And then, finally, Monica was arrested. When she was booked into jail, she showed little emotion, no visible signs of shock, no tears. Her mugshot revealed a woman composed, almost serene. The woman who had once been known for her elegance and control was now at the centre of one of Los Angeles's most shocking domestic crime cases. And as she sat in a holding cell awaiting trial, the question that lingered in every courtroom hallway, in every newscast, in every whispered conversation was the same. Had Monica truly believed she could get away with it? Chapter 3. The Affair Revealed. For months, the whispers lived only in encrypted messages. They were hidden behind burner apps, whispered during stolen gym sessions, and erased from call logs the moment they ended. Monica Cementilli, the grieving wife, had a secret. And that secret had a name, Robert Baker. In the public eye, Monica was still cloaked in widowhood. To many, she was simply a woman enduring the unthinkable, the loss of a husband in a brutal and senseless crime. But behind that grief was a dangerous duality, wife and betrayer, victim and architect. What began as a flirtation had become something toxic, obsessive and fatal. The first glimpse of Baker. Robert Baker was not the kind of man most would associate with a high-profile housewife from an affluent Los Angeles suburb. He was rugged, street smart, and intense. A former racquetball coach with a checkered past, he had once worked in adult films under a pseudonym. Later in life, he bounced between fitness gigs and odd jobs. He had a criminal record, including an assault conviction and a listing on the sex offender registry. But in his daily life, he wore a mask of charm and confidence. When Monica first met Robert at the racquetball club, the connection was immediate. Fabio had introduced them. Fabio had trusted him. Robert began working with both Fabio and their daughter, Isabella, as a trainer. He was charismatic, attentive, and always complimentary. But while Fabio focused on technique and conversation, Monica noticed the way Robert looked at her when no one else was watching. He made her feel seen, important, alive. Escaping the marriage without leaving it. Over time, Monica's daily routine became shaped around Robert. She adjusted her schedule. She made excuses. She began spending hours at the gym, sometimes with the kids, sometimes alone. What she didn't say was that much of that time wasn't spent on fitness at all. They met in parking lots. They talked in whispers. They used burner phones to avoid detection. And most importantly, they began talking about what came next. Robert fed her the words she wanted to hear, that Fabio didn't appreciate her, that she deserved more, that they belonged together, that he would take care of her, if only the obstacle in their way was removed. Monica never had to say the words outright. She didn't have to. The implication was enough. The text messages. When detectives finally unlocked Monica's digital world, they found a cascade of communication between her and Robert Baker. Nearly 10,000 text messages were recovered over a six-month period. What stood out wasn't just the frequency, it was the content. Some messages were filled with lust, explicit fantasies and photos. Others were emotional. Long messages about being trapped in a life Monica said she no longer recognised. But more disturbing were the texts that hinted at planning. They spoke in codes, referred to the trip or the break. They joked about being in the clear by summer. They discussed locations and routes. At one point, Monica wrote, "We just need to time this right. You know when." Robert responded, "No mistakes, in and out. You've got to stick to the story." These weren't just lovers venting frustrations. They were partners in something darker. Manipulation or mutual obsession. One of the most debated elements of the case became this. Was Monica manipulating Robert into killing for her, or had they both spiraled into a delusion that justified murder? Experts who later reviewed their communications suggested it was both. Monica was intelligent. She understood boundaries. She never gave direct instructions. Instead, she leaned into guilt, affection, and fantasy. She painted herself as the victim in a loveless marriage. She made Robert feel like the hero of her story. In turn, Robert, already prone to impulsivity and emotional instability, clung to her words like oxygen. She became his reason, his excuse, his obsession. To outsiders, it seemed absurd. How could a man kill for a woman he'd known for only a short time? But history is filled with such stories of people who confuse lust for love and control for devotion. The plan takes shape. By November 2016, they had decided on a timeline. Fabio travelled frequently, but was scheduled to be home for a two-week stretch in January. Monica told Robert this would be the ideal window. She said she would leave the house for an errand. She would make sure Fabio was outside, alone, near the pool where he liked to relax in the afternoons. She would leave the side gate unlatched. She would disable the security system through her phone. She would act normal. She would cry when it was over. Robert agreed, but he didn't plan to go alone. The accomplice. Enter Christopher Austin. A former Marine and a longtime acquaintance of Baker's, Austin was the kind of man who stayed in the shadows. He had struggled with addiction, was barely scraping by, and had a history of violence. When Baker approached him with a job that paid a few thousand dollars, No questions asked, Austin accepted. He was told very little, just enough. The plan was simple. Get in. Do the job. Get out. Monica would confirm when Fabio was home. She'd give the signal. The Porsche would be used for the getaway. What they didn't count on was Fabio's strength, or his refusal to go quietly. The attack. On the day of the murder, everything unfolded within minutes. Monica left the house around 3:25 p.m. after receiving a message from Robert. Ready, she replied. Go. She drove to a nearby store and lingered there, pacing the aisles, checking her phone, pretending to shop. Back at the house, Fabio was sitting by the pool. The air was quiet. The house was empty. Two figures in hooded sweatshirts entered through the side gate. One carried a knife. Fabio never stood a chance. The first blow was sharp and fast, catching him by surprise, but he fought back, hard. Scratches, bruises, and defensive wounds later showed he fought until his final breath. He clawed at his attackers, one of whom left DNA under Fabio's fingernails. Fabio tried to run, but was pushed to the ground. The attack was relentless. By the time Isabella came home less than an hour later, the scene was silent again, except for the sound of water lapping at the edge of the bloodied pool. Aftermath of the affair. Following the murder, Monica returned home and played her role. She wailed. She clung to her daughters. She collapsed into the arms of neighbours. But in the days after, cracks began to show. She reached out to Robert in secret. She told him not to call or text anymore. She reminded him to keep his story straight. Robert panicked. He tried to leave the city but was tracked by detectives through his cell phone. Christopher Austin, meanwhile, was already unravelling. He confessed to a friend that he had done something bad and felt like he was being followed. It was only a matter of time before everything fell apart. And when detectives arrested Robert and Christopher, the full story of Monica's betrayal began to emerge. The question of love. Was it love? Was it manipulation? Or was it simply a con that spiraled into murder? Psychologists called in to consult on the case described it as pathological intimacy, a dangerous cocktail of loneliness, narcissism, and a hunger for control. Monica didn't kill with her hands. She didn't need to. She seduced with words. She built a fantasy that made murder seem like a form of escape. And in Robert Baker, she found someone willing to turn fantasy into action. For investigators, that made her just as culpable. Because at the heart of it all, beneath the sex, the secrets, and the strategy, was one undeniable fact. Fabio Sementili was dead, and Monica wasn't crying anymore. Chapter 4, Forensics Don't Lie. Detective Angel Velasquez stood at the edge of the pool, staring at the faint outlines of blood, now dried and baked into the brick patio. It had been days since the attack, but the scene clung to him. A man was brutally murdered in his own backyard, and there were no signs of forced entry, no struggle inside, no stolen valuables. Something didn't sit right. This wasn't random. This wasn't burglary. This was personal. As Velasquez walked through the silent house, he knew it wasn't just instinct driving that thought. It was experience. 20 years on the force, and murder scenes told their own stories. The problem was that this one didn't scream. It whispered. Until the lab results came in. The first major break. Days after the murder, the Los Angeles County Crime Lab delivered its first set of results. Beneath Fabio's fingernails, embedded deep into the skin, was DNA. It was male, not familial. And it didn't match anyone in the household. That meant one thing. Fabio had fought for his life and managed to scratch one of his attackers. The sample was rushed through forensic databases. It came back with a hit: Robert Baker. Robert had a criminal record. Years earlier, he had served time for assault and was registered as a sex offender. His DNA was in the system. That single genetic match flipped the case. Baker was no longer just a background character. He was now a prime suspect. The Porsche and the vanishing footage. Detectives then turned their attention to Fabio's black Porsche 911, which had gone missing on the day of the murder and was found abandoned in a parking lot the next day. Inside the car, crime scene techs found gloves, a torn hoodie, and traces of blood. On the steering wheel, partial fingerprints. On the passenger seat, a single strand of dark hair. The items were bagged and sent for processing. That strand of hair, a match to Christopher Austin. The gloves had fibres linking back to a gym bag found in Robert Baker's apartment. And the prints? Smudged, but consistent with both suspects. But perhaps the most important discovery wasn't in the Porsche or the pool. It was in the house. Fabio had recently upgraded the security system, a state-of-the-art setup with multiple exterior cameras, motion sensors, and cloud backups. The DVR that stored the footage? Gone. It had been physically ripped from its mount inside the home. That alone raised suspicions. Why would a burglar care about the DVR unless they knew it held something incriminating? That's when investigators examined cloud access records and discovered someone had logged in remotely using Monica's credentials at 3:47 p.m. on the day of the murder, just minutes before her husband was stabbed to death. The digital trail. The LAPD's cyber unit began pulling digital records. They retrieved cell tower pings, app login data, GPS movement logs, and messaging app usage. Monica's phone showed she had opened the home security app multiple times that afternoon. She checked the driveway camera, she toggled the gate view, and she did so from a Target parking lot a few miles away. The timing was too precise to be coincidence. The moment she left the house, Robert and Christopher approached. The moment she checked the cameras, Fabio was attacked. The moment she saw it was done, she stopped checking altogether. Police retrieved her texts. In one message to Robert, sent just hours before the murder, Monica had typed, "Just remember, quick and clean, no mistakes." That message would later be dissected in court, but it wasn't just the digital trail that betrayed Monica. It was also the lack of panic afterward. Behaviour after the crime. When Isabella called 911 and Monica returned home, witnesses said her behaviour seemed dramatic but oddly controlled. She screamed, "Yes." She cried, "Yes." But when detectives began asking questions, her answers were cautious, precise, too precise. She said she didn't know anyone who would want to hurt Fabio, that he had no enemies, that their marriage was loving, if distant, that they had been discussing couples therapy, that he was under a lot of stress. But Monica never asked who might have done this. She never asked about suspects. She never asked about the investigation's progress. Instead, she asked about one thing: the insurance. The life insurance policy. Fabio had a $1.6 million life insurance policy. He had listed Monica as the sole beneficiary years earlier. When he updated the policy in 2016, he reaffirmed that designation. After the murder, Monica contacted the insurer within days. She claimed the payout was essential for supporting her daughters. She wanted the process expedited. She didn't mention that she was under investigation. She didn't disclose that police had asked for access to her devices. The insurance company flagged the claim. They contacted law enforcement, and from that point on, Monica's fate was sealed. The interrogation strategy. LAPD didn't arrest Monica immediately. They built the case slowly. They continued surveillance. They analysed her routines. They recorded jail calls between her and Robert after his arrest. They watched as she lied to his family, telling them she hadn't spoken to him in months, despite daily contact proven by phone logs. Then they brought in Christopher Austin. He cracked. Austin admitted that Robert had asked him to help with something serious, that he'd been offered a few thousand dollars to scare a guy, that he didn't know it would escalate to murder, but once it did, he panicked. He told detectives that Monica was in on it, that she was the one who set the table. Building the case. Detectives organised a timeline. Weeks before the murder, Monica and Robert exchange hundreds of texts. She gives him Fabio's schedule. 2 days before the murder, she tells Robert the cameras have been acting up. Morning of the murder, she checks the camera feed twice. Afternoon of the murder, she leaves the gate unlocked. She logs in remotely. She watches it unfold. Evening of the murder, she returns home. She performs grief. 2 days after, she contacts the insurer. 1 week after, she deletes texts. She stops using the encrypted app. 1 month later, she changes her phone. None of it looked like the actions of a grieving widow. It looked like the blueprint of someone cleaning up. The arrest. On June 14, 2017, LAPD officers arrived at Monica's home with a warrant. She answered the door calmly. Her daughters were inside. She didn't protest. She didn't cry. She didn't say a word as they placed her in handcuffs and read her her rights. She was charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. Robert Baker and Christopher Austin were already in custody. But Monica's arrest sent shockwaves through the family and the industry that had once revered her husband. Fabio's colleagues were stunned. His children were devastated. His sister, Mirella, would later say, "This wasn't just betrayal. This was slaughter from the inside." A silent storm. As Monica sat in jail awaiting trial, she remained stoic. She denied involvement. Her attorneys claimed she was being framed. They said she had no knowledge of the plan, that Robert acted alone, that the messages were taken out of context. But the evidence told a different story. DNA doesn't lie. Text logs don't lie. Remote app access doesn't lie. And in the end, all roads led back to her. The wife who watched her husband die from a distance, the lover who whispered escape, the widow who planned every step, except how to hide from the truth. Chapter 5. Arrests and Confessions. It was a hot summer morning in Los Angeles when the first handcuffs clicked shut. June 14th, 2017. Robert Baker was arrested outside a small fitness centre in Reseda, California. He had just wrapped up a private racquetball session when two unmarked vehicles pulled up and surrounded him. Officers approached quietly but firmly. There was no scene, no struggle. Baker didn't run. He stood still as they took his wrists, face unreadable, like he knew this day would eventually come. He was charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder in the death of Fabio Cementilli. At the time, few knew this arrest was only the first domino to fall. 2 hours later, in a quieter but equally calculated operation, Monica Cementilli was arrested at her home. She had been baking. That detail would later haunt one of the officers who escorted her out. She wore an apron, her hands dusted with flour. Her daughters watched as she was led away, their faces pale and speechless. There were no tears. Not from her. She simply turned to the lead officer and said, "This is a mistake." Booking and silence. At LAPD headquarters, Monica was booked and fingerprinted. Her mugshot captured a composed but cold expression, no panic, no plea, no shock. During questioning, she invoked her right to remain silent. Robert Baker, however, didn't. He denied any involvement in Fabio's murder. He claimed he had been home alone on the day of the attack, watching television. But his phone records placed him within three blocks of the Cementili residence during the time of the murder. His DNA had been found under Fabio's fingernails. His text history with Monica included details that only someone close to the crime could know. Still, he insisted, "I didn't kill anyone." Detectives didn't believe him, but they also suspected he hadn't acted alone. The weakest link. The key to breaking open the conspiracy came not from Monica or Robert, but from the third man in the shadows, Christopher Austin. At first, Austin had been silent. A former Marine turned drifter, he had a criminal record, a troubled past, and little to lose. But as the evidence against him mounted, including fingerprints in Fabio's Porsche and a confession he'd made to an old friend, prosecutors saw an opportunity. They offered him a deal. Reduce charges in exchange for testimony. Austin cracked. And once he did, the full story emerged. Austin's statement. In his confession, Christopher Austin detailed the plan from beginning to end. He said Robert Baker had approached him in early January 2017 with a job that involved intimidating a man. He claimed he didn't know the specifics at first, but Robert promised money and made it clear the target was some rich guy who wouldn't fight back. Austin admitted he was desperate. He agreed without asking questions. But as the plan came into focus, he realized what was really happening. On the day of the murder, Austin said he followed Robert to the Cementili residence. Monica had already left. The gate was unlocked. The security system was down. They crept around the back. Fabio was by the pool, headphones in. Robert made the first move, lunging at Fabio from behind with a knife. Fabio fought back hard. Austin panicked. Blood flew. There was shouting, grunts, splashes, then silence. Austin said he never meant to kill anyone. But after it happened, Robert told him to stay quiet and follow the plan. Monica will take care of it, Robert said. She's got it covered. The jailhouse letters. After their arrests, Monica and Robert were kept in separate detention facilities. Jailhouse phone calls were monitored, so were the letters. Prosecutors would later present a series of messages Monica wrote to Robert under the guise of friendship. In them, she reminded him to stay strong, to remember what we planned, and to not let fear win. One line stood out: "No one else knows our truth. They can guess, but only we know the why." To the prosecution, that was a confession. To the defense, it was a misinterpretation of two grieving people caught in a nightmare. But there was a deeper issue unfolding behind bars. Robert was beginning to question Monica's loyalty. He learned she had spoken with the insurance company days after the murder. He learned she had deleted text messages. He learned she had told police she hadn't seen him in months. That betrayal cut deep, and slowly, Robert's loyalty started to crack. The grand jury. With confessions in hand, prosecutors convened a grand jury. Over several weeks, witnesses testified. Friends, neighbours, former colleagues, and even the couple's eldest daughter, Jessica, spoke under oath. She described her parents' rocky relationship, her mother's withdrawn behaviour, and moments that now felt like red flags. The forensic evidence was laid out. Monica's access to the security app during the murder, the flood of texts between her and Robert, the life insurance policy, and her rapid attempt to claim it. Robert's DNA under Fabio's fingernails, Christopher Austin's first-hand account, the grand jury returned an indictment on all counts. Plea deals and legal strategy. In the months that followed, prosecutors worked to avoid a costly and traumatic trial for Fabio's family. Christopher Austin accepted a plea deal in exchange for full cooperation. He pled guilty to second-degree murder and received a sentence of 25 years to life, with the possibility of parole. Robert Baker, facing overwhelming evidence and a growing sense of abandonment, began negotiating through his attorney. After nearly 6 years behind bars, in July 2023, he pled no contest to first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. He received a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. He never testified against Monica, but his silence was telling. When asked during sentencing if he had any words for Fabio's family, Robert paused and simply said, "I regret everything. I was a fool." Monica stands alone. By 2024, Monica Cementilli stood as the last pillar of the conspiracy still fighting her case. Her legal team painted her as a woman betrayed by a lover, by circumstance, and by assumptions. They claimed she had been manipulated by Robert Baker, that she never intended for Fabio to die, that she had no idea what Robert was planning. But the evidence didn't support that story. The text messages, the remote access logs, the timing, the lies. Prosecutors made it clear, Monica was not an unwitting pawn. She was the architect, the puppet master, the one who watched it all unfold from a parking lot, then cried crocodile tears as her daughters broke down beside their father's body. The emotional toll. For Fabio's family, the arrests were both a relief and a source of pain. His son, Luigi, who had once called Monica his second mom, cut ties immediately. At sentencing hearings, he spoke with tears in his eyes. "She didn't just destroy my father," he said. "She destroyed our family. She broke all of us. And she did it with a smile on her face." Fabio's sister, Mirella, became the family's voice in public. "She thought she was smarter than everyone. She thought she could lie her way through this. But the truth has a way of catching up." And it did. Countdown to trial. Monica remained in custody for nearly 8 years awaiting trial. Her legal team filed motions, requested delays, and attempted to suppress digital evidence, but the walls continued to close in. In April 2025, the trial finally began. Fabio's daughters were now young women. The media returned in full force. And Monica walked into that courtroom, no longer the grieving widow. She was the accused mastermind behind a calculated, cold-blooded killing. What the jury would decide next would determine whether she'd ever walk free again. Chapter 6. Monica's trial begins. April 2025. Los Angeles County Superior Court. 8 years after Fabio Cementilli's murder, the courtroom buzzed with a nervous tension as Monica Cementilli entered, flanked by armed deputies. Her hair was darker now, pulled tightly into a bun. Her face was sharper, gaunt, composed, deliberate. But what struck observers most wasn't her physical transformation, it was her eyes, cold, focused, calculating. This wasn't the image of a grieving widow. This was a defendant facing the possibility of dying in prison. The courtroom was packed. Fabio's family occupied the first two rows. Journalists filled the back benches. And to the right of the defense table, a pair of prosecutors methodically sorted through dozens of evidence binders, photos, texts, surveillance screenshots, insurance documents, forensic analysis. The trial was ready to begin. Jury selection and strategy. The prosecution sought jurors who would see beyond grief and charisma, people who could focus on motive, timeline and forensic truth. The defence aimed for sceptics, individuals who distrusted the criminal justice system, had experience with domestic trauma or believed in the idea of false imprisonment. The final jury was a cross-section of Los Angeles, men and women from a mix of backgrounds, ages and professions. One was a retired nurse, another a postal worker. Several had children, none had ties to law enforcement. Opening statements began on a Tuesday morning. The lead prosecutor, a woman known for her calm but lethal courtroom style, began with a line that cut the silence. "This case is not about grief. It is about greed. It is about lust. And it is about betrayal so deep it ended in blood." She painted a timeline of deliberate planning. She described Monica's affair with Robert Baker, her financial motives, and her calculated manipulation of everyone around her, including her own children. The defence fired back. Their lead attorney, a sharp, seasoned litigator with a theatrical flair, stood before the jury and said, "This is a story of assumptions, of circumstantial evidence, of a woman who lost her husband, only to be framed by a killer who couldn't handle rejection." The stage was set. The evidence reconstructed. Over the course of 3 weeks, the jury was led through the case, piece by piece. The digital trail. The prosecution began with the data, Monica's access logs to the home security system, time-stamped entries showing her disabling cameras remotely, GPS and cell tower data proving she was monitoring the house during the time of the murder. Jurors were shown the access logs in sequence. One juror covered her mouth when the prosecution narrated how Monica had logged in 90 seconds before the attack and never checked again afterward. The insurance motive. Next came the money. Fabio's $1.6 million life insurance policy had been updated just months before his death. Monica was the sole beneficiary. She had contacted the insurer within days of the murder, before Fabio had even been buried. An insurance rep testified that Monica appeared more focused on paperwork than grief. She had asked if she could expedite processing. She never once asked if the payout would be impacted by the nature of the death. The affair and messages. Then came the affair. Text message logs between Monica and Robert Baker were introduced into evidence. Thousands of messages. Most were routine. Many were romantic. But the prosecution zeroed in on those that suggested premeditation. One exchange read, "Monica, once it's done, I'll be free." "Robert, I'm ready. We're close now." Another read, "Monica, no mistakes, no hesitation. This is our life now." The courtroom murmured. The defence objected, suggesting the texts were ambiguous, taken out of context, even fabricated. But the prosecution stood firm. "Words matter," the lead attorney said, "and these words are chilling." The turncoat witness. Perhaps the most devastating moment of the trial came with the testimony of Christopher Austin, Robert Baker's one-time accomplice, now a witness for the state. Austin entered the courtroom in prison orange, shackled at the ankles. He spoke in a flat, almost hollow voice. But his words landed like bricks. He described the plan. He described Monica's role. He described how she left the gate unlocked and confirmed Fabio's location that afternoon. He even recalled Monica's warning, "Don't hurt the girls, just him." When asked by the prosecutor, "Who planned the murder?" he answered without hesitation, "Monica. She was the one who started it. Robert just did what she wanted." On cross-examination, the defence tried to paint Austin as unreliable, a criminal, a liar who made a deal to save himself. But Austin never flinched. "I'm no saint," he said. But I didn't love her. Robert did. That's why he did what she asked. Monica's defence. When it came time for the defence to present its case, Monica's team took a calculated risk. She would not testify. Instead, they focused on creating doubt that Robert Baker acted alone, driven by obsession, that Monica's texts were romantic, not criminal, that Christopher Austin's story was a self-serving lie. They called on a forensic linguist who testified that the messages could be interpreted multiple ways. A psychologist argued Monica had been emotionally manipulated by Baker. Friends described Monica as a loyal mother, a quiet wife, and someone incapable of violence. But their case was missing something the prosecution had in spades: evidence. At closing arguments, the defense appealed to emotion. You've seen a woman buried in loss. A woman whose husband was ripped from her. Now she's on trial for something she didn't do. But the prosecution ended on logic. The cameras don't lie. The texts don't lie. The blood doesn't lie. She watched it happen. She planned it. And now she must face it. Jury deliberation. The jury deliberated for 4 days. Fabio's family waited outside, holding hands in silence. His daughters, now young adults, remained quiet throughout. Their pain was visible but private. On the fifth day, the jury returned. 12 people, tense, focused. The clerk read the verdict. Guilty on all counts. First-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, special circumstances, lying in wait and financial gain. Monica Cementilli showed no emotion, not a tear, not a flinch. She stared forward as if the words didn't belong to her. A family torn in two. After the verdict, Fabio's son Luigi gave a victim impact statement. His voice cracked but never broke. She raised me. She made my lunch. She helped me with homework. And then she planned my father's murder. I don't know how to forgive that. Fabio's sister, Mirella, looked directly at Monica as she spoke. You tried to erase him, but all you did was erase yourself. The world sees you now. Even Robert Baker, from his own prison cell, issued a brief statement. I was used. I was blind, and I will die in here knowing I was a fool. Monica declined to speak at her sentencing hearing. She offered no apology, no explanation, nothing. Sentencing. June 23rd, 2025. Monica Cementilli was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge, stern and unsparing, called the crime cold, calculated, and remorseless. You used love as a weapon. You manipulated those who trusted you, and you watched a man die for your convenience. And with that, the case was closed. But for Fabio's family, there was no closure. Only quiet. And the long road of healing. Chapter 7. Verdict, legacy, and aftermath, June 24th, 2025. The courtroom was quiet now. The cameras had packed up. Reporters had moved on to the next scandal, the next headline. But for the Cementilli family, the story wasn't over. It never would be. Monica Cementilli had been sentenced to life without parole. No appeals were filed in the first week. No statements from her attorneys, no press conferences, just silence. 8 years of grief, investigation, and courtroom drama had come to a close, but the wreckage remained. Because even when justice is served, it doesn't bring the dead back. It doesn't erase the trauma from a daughter's memory or mend the hollowed-out space in a son's heart. Justice is a verdict. Grief is a life sentence. Fabio's legacy. In the beauty world, Fabio Cementilli had been more than a stylist. He was a mentor, a coach, a force of positivity and encouragement. His colleagues spoke about him with reverence. He lifted people up. He inspired confidence. In the months following Monica's conviction, several international salons began organising educational scholarships in Fabio's name. The Fabio Sementili Foundation for Beauty Education was launched by his eldest daughter and son. Its mission, to provide free training and resources for underprivileged stylists around the world. His former company held a global tribute. Videos of Fabio mentoring stylists, hugging colleagues, laughing on stage were played across monitors in Europe, Asia, and North America. He had wanted to make the beauty industry better. In many ways, he still was. But inside his family, the pain was still raw. The children. Fabio's daughters, Jessica and Isabella, had been teenagers when their father was murdered. They had grown up in the long shadow of grief and media attention. First, they had to bury their father. Then, they had to accept the unthinkable, that their own mother may have played a role. The trial years were the hardest. Every holiday was quiet. Every Father's Day felt like a wound. Every news story about the case reopened something inside them. At the sentencing, Jessica chose not to speak publicly, but in a letter read by the prosecutor, she wrote, "My mother taught me to be strong, and then she taught me what betrayal feels like. I will never understand why. I only know that my father deserved so much better." Isabella never gave a statement. She hasn't spoken to her mother since the arrest. Luigi's fight. Luigi Sementili, Fabio's son from a previous relationship, became the public face of the family's pursuit of justice. He had been in his early 20s when the murder happened. After Monica's arrest, he vowed to see the case through. He showed up at hearings. He spoke to the press. He comforted his sisters. He also fought to ensure that Monica would never profit from the insurance payout. In 2019, a civil lawsuit filed by the family blocked any financial gains connected to Fabio's death. The money was redirected to the children. At a memorial in 2025, Luigi stood before a room of stylists and said, "My dad lived with heart, he died with dignity, and today we reclaim his name from the lies that tried to bury it." Monica in prison. Monica Sementili is now inmate number 8756041. She resides at the Central California Women's Facility, one of the largest women's prisons in the United States. She is not allowed contact with her children. She works in the prison library. Inmates describe her as quiet, polite, but distant. She rarely speaks of her past. No public apology has ever been issued. No confession, no remorse. It's as if Monica lives in a different version of the truth, one where she's the victim, the framed wife, the misunderstood widow. But the jury didn't believe it. The evidence didn't support it. And her silence now speaks louder than anything she said in court. Reflections from the investigation. Detective Angel Velasquez, now retired, said the Sementili case still lingers in his mind. "This wasn't just a murder, it was betrayal in the cruelest form. A man who trusted his wife completely was killed while she watched from a distance." He remembered Monica's behaviour during the early days of the investigation. Too calm, too rehearsed, too controlled. When people lie, you can feel it. And with her, it was like standing next to an empty room. Something was missing. To Velasquez, the digital evidence told the real story. She didn't stab him, but she knew and she watched. A final farewell. On the eighth anniversary of Fabio's death, the family gathered at the poolside where it all happened. The home had long been sold, but the new owners allowed the family access for one evening. Candles were lit, rose petals were floated on the surface of the water, a violinist played softly nearby, one of Fabio's favourite songs from his youth in Toronto. Each child said a few words. Fabio's sister wept quietly. Then Luigi stepped forward.
"You were taken from us by someone who was supposed to protect you, but we won't let that be your ending. We'll carry your light every day, every time we stand up for what's right."
They released a single white balloon into the California sky. It drifted upward, then disappeared. The unanswered questions. Even with convictions, confessions, and a closed case, the story leaves behind questions that have no clear answers. Why did Monica do it? Was it just the money? Was it years of resentment? Was it about love or power? Some believe she had been planning the murder long before she met Robert Baker. Others think she was swept up in something she couldn't control. But one fact remains. She had options. She could have left, she could have divorced him, she could have walked away, but she didn't. Instead, she watched the man who trusted her die alone, while she stood outside a Target parking lot, checking her camera app. A lesson in duality. The Cementilli case isn't just a true crime story, it's a study in duality. Of public masks and private agendas, of love turned lethal, of silence louder than screams. Fabio Cementilli was a man of joy, of kindness, of passion. And Monica Cementilli, his wife of over 20 years, was the person he trusted most. In the end, it was that trust that killed him.